Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Green and Blacks, a rich, smooth, and truly delicious chocolate experience. You're listening to the Irish Times Women's Podcast. I'm Roisin Ingle. Now, back around 100 years ago, before the pandemic, early March, I think it was, a different world, we interviewed Morning Ireland presenter and best-selling author Rachel English about her latest novel, Paper Bracelet. And she was great, as always.
It did mean sort of lead to a situation where I did have to, you know, bring my colleagues together and say, now, I swear I'm not making this up. But thing is, I wrote this book and I was going to tell you about it and then I put it off and I put it off and I put it off. But anyway, there'll be a thing in the paper tomorrow about it.
And we are going to finally bring you that pre-pandemic conversation today. I have to say, The Paper Bracelet is a great read, something to bring on your staycation wherever you might be going, if you're lucky enough to have somewhere to go. And I really hope you are. I am dying to go to the west of Ireland with my mum and swim in the sea. And oh my God, anyway, it's the simple things, isn't it? The simple things you miss. But before I bring you that chat with Rachel English, I wanted to let you know some news from the webinar on mental health and domestic violence in lockdown that was run by the National Women's Council of Ireland and St. Patrick's. And you'll remember last week we had two women on telling us about why the mental health of women was being particularly affected during the pandemic. So I wanted to let you know some of the very important things that have come out of that webinar on Friday. There was a very good report in The Examiner about it, which said that at the webinar, it emerged from somebody speaking at it that the Irish courts are not fit for purpose when dealing with violence against women. And that came from an expert on gender-based violence. So what was said was that the legal process here often re-traumatizes victims, locking them into archaic systems, blind to the subtleties of coercive control. The Istanbul Convention was ratified in Ireland last year and is supposed to prevent and combat violence against women, gives a sort of a roadmap towards a safer world for women. But those measures had not yet filtered through into domestic laws and practices. And that was said by Dubravka Simonovic, who's the UN Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women. She said the criminal justice system currently lacks the laws and procedures to adequately deal with the rape and sexual violence women are experiencing during lockdown. And Simonovic has been gathering data on femicide since 2015. And she has shown that 80% of people killed in an intimate partner relationship are women. And she mused and wondered, at the end of this year, are we going to look at those statistics and will those numbers of women killed by intimate partners have increased? And of course, as you know, or might not know, in the UK, they've actually found that that's exactly right. Already this year, the numbers of women killed by intimate partners has increased. So it's very likely that we are going to find the same here after lockdown. Now, sexual violence and rape have been a particularly harrowing issue for many women throughout lockdown, but these are crimes that are not often seen in the context of domestic abuse. And that was said by Nolene Blackwell of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. There was also talk about a report that had been promised by the Department of Justice examining how victims are treated within the criminal justice system. And that report is 2 years overdue. And meanwhile, victims of sexual and gender-based violence have had to grapple with a system that's not designed to support them. And Nolene Blackwell said, we have a duty to protect and promote people's rights to live without sexual violence and to ensure that they have access to justice and support if they do. Also speaking at the webinar was Mary Louise Lynch, who is a founder of Survivors Informing Services and Institutions, which is a domestic and sexual violence project. And she said that many women continue to be abused post-separation due to a system that doesn't accept coercive control or doesn't understand it and the complexities of abuse. Now, we've spoken on this podcast before how coercive control is now illegal and those laws are in place, but it's very new. And Marie-Louise Lynch was saying that the system just doesn't recognise it post-separations. She said courts and children are often manipulated by abusers to continue to exert control post-separation. And this has led to women feeling forced to put photos of their rapist up in their house or risk being accused of alienating their child's father, she said, which is just horrific. And one woman that they surveyed recently found that her ex-partner was coming back to Ireland from the UK throughout lockdown every 3 weeks to visit their child. I mean, which is just outrageous on so many levels. And this woman is terrified when she has to meet him in a deserted car park during lockdown to hand over their child, who he has taken to stay in a packed hostel, a refugee hostel during the pandemic. I mean, it's just incredible what women are going through and the stories that we're not hearing, which is why this webinar was so important. Sarah Benson of Women's Aid, who's been on this podcast talking about the subject, said that COVID-19 has been the perfect storm for people for whom home is not a safe space. The service has received spiking calls from March to May with, I think it's really nice of Sarah Benson. She calls these people ingenious survivors, but it's just horrific. Ingenious survivors calling from sheds, cars and in the middle of the night to get through without being overheard. But Miss Benson said that she's worried about those who cannot call. I mean, when this is all over, I really do hope we hear about these things and we hear every story of every woman who had to go out into a shed or a car in the middle of the night to try and get help, because this is all going on and we're dealing with the things that we see in front of us, you know, worrying about various issues, and we all have things to worry about. But I just can't. I just, all through this lockdown, I've been thinking of those women in their houses, stuck with somebody or dealing with someone who they finally got rid of, but who's still hassling them through the lockdown. Anyway, it's an issue we've covered extensively on the podcast and we will be coming back to it. And just to remind you, in case you're struggling with any of these issues or if you know somebody who is, the Gardaí are on red alert for all of this and you really should call them with any concerns, and also reach out to people like Women's Aid or the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. Don't go through this alone. Tell your friends not to go through this alone. Get help. Try and get justice, even if, as the webinar showed, justice is often not served in so many of these cases. And that's why we have to keep talking about it and highlighting it. Now, Rachel English is an Irish broadcaster and writer. She's currently the host of Morning Ireland on RTE from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m, which she began hosting in 2010. She has done loads of things in RTE, where she's worked for 30 years. She presented 5-7 Live for 6 years, and other radio shows like the RTE News at 1, Today with Pat Kenny, the Marion Finucan Show, The Late Debate. She's part-time now on Morning Ireland, which gives loads of time for her other career as a novelist. And she came into the Irish Times studio, I wonder will we ever be back there again, in pre-pandemic times. And since then, we just never got the chance to put this conversation out. So we're fixing that now. We were talking about Rachel's fifth book, The Paper Bracelet, which is centred around the mysteries and tragedies of a mother and baby home in the west of Ireland. It's a gripping read and really interesting in terms of how the state treated women back then and all those consequences for the lives of so many women and their babies, now grown-ups, obviously, that are still echoing today. It was a great chat, and here she is, Rachel English. You have an uncanny knack of putting out novels that somehow chime with what's going on in Irish society. And you've done it before with American Girl, but this latest one, The Paper Bracelet, continues that story of these mother and baby homes in Ireland that everyone is still grappling with, and we're still trying to uncover and untangle the truth about it. Why did you return to that subject?
I suppose it's the question you always ask yourself, why this story? And after I wrote The American Girl, I think I had intended to return to the story at some stage, if only in the sense that I kind of felt, well, if I wrote it again, I'd write a better book. And I know there are a lot of stories. And it's funny, I read this quote the other day and I have to re-quote it. It's from Anne Enright and it's so good.
Oh, she's eminently quotable.
Yeah, she said, "We're very fortunate to have Ireland to write about. It's a great resource."
True.
And You would probably say the same if you came from Mexico or Nigeria or Croatia or wherever. But the country you know, you do start to see as a resource in terms of the stories that are there. And I went ahead and I wrote another book called The Night of the Party. And then I wrote maybe about 15,000 words of another book. But I found that all the ideas I was having, they all went back to this story, every little snatch. And I found that I was, you know, printing out stuff that I saw, or I was tearing a thing out of a newspaper and putting them. I have a box and thinking I'll return to that box one day. And in the end, I had this kind of straightforward idea about this Katie character who essentially, you know, a woman who worked in a mother and baby home, who 50 years later, after the death of her husband, decides that she can do something to help the people, the women and their children who were in the home when she was there. And that she kind of becomes a detective like figure, and that she has an assistant in her niece. And I went to my editor and I said, what do you think? Actually, no, first of all, I went to my husband, who's great because he never gets carried away with stuff. Like, do you know,
he's
dispassionate and who would say, yeah, it's okay. But in this instance, he said, oh, you've got to write that. So then I went to Kira Considine, my editor, and she said, oh, I think you should write that. Are you very far in the other one? And I said, no, not that far. And she said, oh, just abandon it. And so that's what I did.
So you had two voices saying you're onto a good thing. And it's true, even reading the blurb at the back of the paper bracelet, and then when you get into it, there's something about a very clear mission that this woman is on. And she has these paper bracelets from the time in the mother and baby home. And she's basically trying to trace some of the babies that were there and try and reunite them. Sort of Miss Marple-y kind of.
Yeah, that's how I see her. And there is a reference to that at one stage, which gives her an opportunity to say, no, A, I'm a lot younger than Miss Marple. actually, on a tangent to that, I did want as well to write about an older woman who's not seen as being helpless, behind the times, computer illiterate, because that's not the way older women are now. And all of us, I do it myself, we still tend to fall back into the cliches that, you know, if somebody is in their Katie turns 70 during the course of the book, that they're going to be in some way tuned out of daily life. And she's not like that at all. And I wanted to write a character like that because I'd seen several people complaining that they felt that older women in particular tend to be badly represented in a lot of fiction.
So and such a rich seam as well. And like you say, I mean, my mother's 80-something, well, she'll be 81 in August, and she's on Twitter, and she's, you know, this woman in your book, she's researching everything. If she doesn't know something, she just gets onto Google and finds out about it. So the idea that you get past a certain age and you're suddenly stagnate is really insulting, I think.
It is. And I think we've also seen in recent times through the referendums or whatever, that a lot of older people are very open-minded, far more so than sometimes the caricature would have it, both men and women. And we saw that in the referendums too, where people, you know, had discussions in their family and, you know, as has been said by plenty of people, that the two referendums, one of the reasons they passed by such comprehensive margins was because of the fact that in both cases, so many older people voted yes. They weren't stuck in a view of Ireland 50 years ago. And they were also willing to say that, well, even if personally I might be a little wary of something, I recognise, having spoken to people, that this is probably the right thing to do. And I found a lot, when you heard people talking like that, I found a lot of that very touching. And so I was anxious that there be an older character who, like you say, is just wants to go out there and do some good. And the last thing she wants to be is stuck at home mourning her husband.
On that subject, I just really agree with what you said there. I think people forget as well that these people have lived through all these things, you know, all through these X cases and, you know, all the different things. And they've seen how people have been affected, and they've had loved ones and relations. So, they have a big wealth of experience, of life experience, that younger people, OK, they can see the injustice, but they haven't necessarily had to grapple with it. Whereas these older people had, and they made that decision, you know, to say, in the case of the Eighth Amendment, to say, I don't think that works.
Yeah.
And again, we shouldn't sort of discount views because they're, you know, of a certain age.
Yeah. And in either way, I'm sure there were people also who voted no in either of the referendums, but that didn't mean that they didn't think a great deal about it. And I think the evidence was that people did. Because the amounts of people who I spoke to who said, well, we had a row at home over it, or actually we had a really nice discussion when I was at home at the weekend. You know, I think it's easy sometimes for us here to maybe take on stereotypes from abroad about older people. You know, this OK boomer thing.
Oh, I do. I was OK boomer the other day. I'm not even a boomer. I was disgusted.
I found myself actually a few weeks ago saying to somebody on Twitter, Generation X, actually.
Yeah,
and I think those are categories that aren't always very helpful here, because I think if, like your mother or my parents, you grew up in Ireland in the 1950s, I don't think your life was any bed of roses. And, you know, an awful lot of people either left the country or had a pretty hard time of it. And I was kind of anxious ever before all of that. And I think most younger people as well don't think in such black and white terms. You know, they do have families.
It actually brings up something else I'm interested in. You know, in RTE, there's very strict, and for very good reasons, why you can't give opinions about things, because you're on Morning Ireland and you've been there for a long time and well used to it, I imagine, just sitting on the fence very much for a lot of things, because your listeners need to know that you're impartial and all of that. What happens when, say, marriage equality passes and the referendum on the 8th passes? So we have legal abortion, we have legal same-sex marriage. Are you allowed then to have an opinion on those subjects?
I think it would be best to, in the main, steer away from having an opinion. And sometimes these things are awkward, but I suppose if you believe in this notion of public service broadcasting and that you should be able to stand back for things and that there should be broadcasting that isn't all about one person giving their opinion all the time, well, there is a small element maybe of, if you're in the army, you have to wear the boots and you have to go along with it. Obviously, it's not quite the same as during a referendum campaign. But I think it's fair enough that if you start to chip away at it, where does it end? You know, it is a difficult one. And like I said, obviously it's not quite the same after the white heat of a referendum campaign. But actually, I think by and large, in both of those referendum campaigns, I think the discourse around them was far more civil than a lot of people had predicted. On every side of the arguments, in the main, obviously there are always exceptions, but in the main, that was certainly my experience, even of working, of being on the radio during those campaigns. I didn't feel the same level of hostility or the same venom that would have been there 20 years ago. I really genuinely didn't.
Yeah, and maybe it was the fact that people's attitudes had moved on and had evolved that made that possible. Just going back to The American Girl, because you mentioned it earlier and I didn't really tell people what it was about, but that was about an American girl coming back, being sent from Boston. She got pregnant by her boyfriend and was sent back by her Irish parents to have the baby in a mother and baby home. In fact, the same mother and baby home that's in the paper.
Yeah, it is the same fictional home. Actually, it's funny, the editor in London who's publishing this book late on became concerned about her and said, it's not real, is it? And I said, no, but it was totally understandable. There were a lot of, between mother and baby homes, other residential institutions, county homes, nursing homes, like there were there were a lot of them.
Yeah, exactly. But when you wrote that, I know that you got a lot of feedback from people. So it sort of was a story that people, like I say, are talking about now. There's lots of people who are tracing their birth parents. And I know that some of it inspired the paper bracelet in terms of the letters and emails that you got about it.
There was one email in particular from a woman who contacted me about a particular occurrence in The American Girl, and I just kind of dance around it a little because the family involved are a bit wary of publicity because it is it's difficult for them. But I realised that the woman who was helping this family, that this wasn't the only family she was helping, and that actually I heard from her again the other day, and that there were others, and that she was doing, she was, you know, she wasn't in this for money or greater glory. It was just a thing that she did because she had experience of the system. And so in a way, there was a little, you know, spark there. I think Helen, to a certain extent, might have, you know, set me. Obviously, she bears no resemblance at all to Katie, who's a fictional character. But just perhaps that little spark was there. This notion of somebody going out and trying to help other people, and, you know, emailing people and saying, "Would you, by any chance, know of X, Y, and Z?"
And it is still such a live issue because, like, people like Maeve O'Rourke and various people have done great legal work and representation of people from Magdalen Laundries and Mother and Baby Homes. And there is this kind of difficulty accessing information about yourself, and the state, for reasons that they're saying are, you know, very valid, is withholding certain information that could help people. What do you think about all that? Because you must have done a lot of research to sort of get the bones of the story across.
You know, it struck me the other day, I with the help of a colleague who works in archives in RTE, I went back and dug out some interviews that I did 24 years ago. And I put off doing it because I don't think anybody wants to either read or hear their work from 24 years ago. There's a certain kind of, you know, that I'm going to go, oh my God. But that was awful.
You might be pleasantly surprised though as well.
But actually, you know what the thing was? I was, not by me, but by the sheer power of the stories, and also by the fact that with a couple of edits, you could play it now.
Wow.
It was exactly the same. The only differences were this: that the main woman who I spoke to had managed to trace
her birth
mother.
And this was down in Bessborough in Cork,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, had managed to trace her birth mother. And then there were two or three other women who hadn't. And apart from a couple of things they called for that have since happened, like a register through a national register where you can go and put your name down and hopefully that there will be a match. Apart from that, and I suppose apart from the fact that I also spoke to a nun at the time, and I don't think you'd be doing that now because it's all mainly done through either the Adoption Authority or TUSLA now. Everything they said, if you went and interviewed a similar group of men and women now, they would probably say something similar about how it's just too difficult, and I don't want to intrude upon her life. But there's every chance she might want to know me, and she doesn't know that I'm out here thinking about her all the time. And I was struck in particular by the woman who had managed to find her birth mother, and she said, I'd forgotten this, but as soon as I listened to it again, I remembered her telling the story about how before she made contact with her birth mother, she found out who she was, and she went and stood outside a family wedding and watched them all. It's just, isn't it just
so sad.
Astonishing? And then she started off, she didn't approach her birth mother first. She approached one of the members of the family, and the first thing, who would be her half-sister, and the first thing her half-sister said to her was, "Well, we can't deny you anyway, you're the image of us." And she was welcomed in.
Wow.
So in that way, it was a great story. And also, I think maybe at the time, to think about the other women, it must have been very important for them that she was there, because she was able to say to them, "Listen, actually, it isn't necessarily the case that the family will balk at meeting you. Actually, there's every chance that they will say something like, 'Well, we can't deny you anyway, you're the image of us.'"
Yeah.
And But it was strange to hear something that, to hear people saying pretty much what people say now about that it's just too difficult to reunite.
And then you just think of the decades upon decades of, you know, secrecy, of pain, of kind of, you know, you've got on the one hand, you've got women with maybe other families sort of shutting off a whole side of their life that was so important and probably, you know, shaped them a lot. And then you've got these other younger people trying to find a piece of their lives. And they do sometimes come together, but often it will never be resolved.
And the more time goes on, the less likely it is to happen. You know, we were talking about tens of thousands of women. I don't know how many are still alive, but obviously it's a dwindling number.
Now, you give a very good statistic in the book, which I don't remember, but you might have off the top of your head.
I do.
Being Rachel English of Morning Ireland.
Yeah,
which was really striking.
But it is striking. And the first time I read this statistic, I didn't believe it. So I had to go and hunt its provenance. It was that in 1967, 97% of children born outside marriage in Ireland were adopted or given up for adoption. So maybe some were fostered, maybe some didn't find permanent homes. But the first time I read that, I read it in a newspaper report by a brilliant Irish Examiner reporter called Conal O'Farrata, who's written a huge amount about this subject. And then I actually interviewed him on Morning Ireland and he said it again. And I thought, well, I've no reason to doubt him, but I would be interested to know where, because his work is so good, I'd be interested to know where it came from. And so it didn't take long to hunt it down. It was first appeared in a book by the historian Lindsay Erner Byrne, who wrote about motherhood in Ireland in the 20th century. And then it also appears in there was a wonderful report came out about 18 months ago by the CLON project, which is a number of academics and also other people who work in this area, who quite reasonably decided that we haven't heard, and you know, that there are an awful lot of women haven't had the opportunity to tell their story about being an institution. And so they went and did some work. It's an amazing report. It's easily accessible online. And again, that statistic appeared. And it's hard to get that out of your head, isn't it? That's a lot of people.
You are listening to the Women's Podcast, brought to you by Green and Black's Organic Chocolate. Discover a different kind of dark.
Moving on to RTE, where you work and have done for how many years? More years than you care to remember.
Okay, I'll admit it, 29.
30 next year, eh? That's a big one. Lots happened in RTE and we've all heard about the cutbacks, and it was sort of a very torrid time there just before Christmas. Gay Byrne died. There was all these announcements of cutbacks and things. What's morale like in the place that you've worked in for 29 years?
Before Christmas, when those announcements were made, it was very strange, and it was the only time. I mean, I used to always joke with people when they asked, "Is morale low in RTE?" And I would say, "Always," you know, because there's always, it's any big organisation. Yeah. Like, let's face it, there are always reasons to complain. But it was the first time that I really felt like, it really was shock, actually. Not that he didn't know that there were serious financial difficulties, but it was a sudden, oh, this is really serious. And this thing that a lot of us have done for a long time and are very, very fond of and very lucky to do, it might not survive. Or certainly if it does, it might not survive in this format, in this way, and a lot might change. Then you had kind of very quickly afterwards, Gay Byrne's death, and then you had sudden death of Marion Fanouk, and then you had Larry Gogan's death, and you know, like everybody, I loved Larry. You know, he really is the one person, well, not the one person, that's not fair, but he was absolutely everything people heard about Larry was absolutely true. He was like, I remember the first time I met him and he said hello to me like I was his equal, and I was kind of, do you know, it did have the, but you go, Hogan, you were on 2FM when I was a child, and you know, and you did Just a Minute, the 60-second quiz. But and then obviously our colleague in the newsroom, Keelan Shanley, died on the day of the election. So it's been a very, very, it really has been a very strange time. And in a way, if you're working in news, and I think anybody, be it newspaper, radio, TV, would say, because of the election and because of everything that's been happening, in a way, there perhaps hasn't been enough time even to think about all of this. You know, it's just everything has been a bit manic. On the day of the sort of 2 days of the election count, I think most people were thinking about Keelan, thinking how much she would have loved it because she loved a story. And
it was such a good story. It was a different election.
It was such a good story. Mm. And, you know, she loved kind of shaking it up a bit and the shock value of something. So and all of that was there, you know, tenfold on the day. And you can't help that, especially somebody who loved live broadcasting and the, you know, the drama of it all, the best day, you know, the best day there's going to be in any year, which is the day with all the drama. So, yeah, it's the last 2 or 3 months have been quite something. All right.
Mm. And I should go back to your 15,000 words of your book, which I think is about a morning news show, which is something that you're very familiar with. Are they all quaking in their boots, Rachel English?
Since this has emerged, I've had, quite a few funny comments thrown my way about people wondering how scared they should be and jokes about solicitors' letters. I should say there are two main characters and only one of them works on a morning news show, but he does. And actually quite early on, he gets suspended and the story spins out from there. But I hope to write it one day.
So do I. I hope to read it. Going back to you as a reader and a writer in childhood, you were born in England, which I think is great because you're English. Rachel English, born in England.
I know. One. Even though that's an Irish name, obviously, that's a kind of Limerick Tipperary name. Like all the Englishes in the main are in Limerick and Tipperary. And whenever I see one from that neck of the woods and somebody says, are you related? I always just say yes, because the chances are that we are.
Yeah. But you, what age were you when you came over?
I was 4. So my mother is English. My father emigrated at the end of the 1950s. He, like an awful lot of people. And he went to Lincolnshire, which in some ways would have been relatively unusual because most people went to Birmingham or Manchester or London or Liverpool.
Yeah.
And he met my mother there. And then in the 1970s, she may have been to Ireland once before that, twice at the most. They came back to Ireland.
How did your dad lure her back? Because, I mean, it sounds like she was sort of settled in her home country.
Yeah.
And had at least one child there. Anyway, yeah, you.
Yeah. And now, to be fair to her, she was very adventurous. Like, she'd lived in Australia for a couple of years herself, which at the time would have been relatively unusual. Do you know, that's a very good question. I mean, I think to begin with, when she got to Ireland, well, she is from a small village in rural Lincolnshire. So perhaps, and we moved at that time to a village in County Limerick. We were living outside Adair. So maybe it wasn't that big of an upheaval. But those were also the years, and it's easy to forget now, when A, it took you 6 months to get a phone. So you weren't going to be contacting your family every day of the week. You weren't going to be sending any texts. And also when airplane tickets were incredibly expensive. And my memory as a child is like she only went home maybe every 3 years or so, which is, when you think of it now, it's would be really unusual. But then that was just the way things were. So she was, even though she's, you know, and then we moved to Shannon, which is obviously there's an airport in the town, but she didn't get to see that much of home for a long time. And they moved then to Shannon in the mid 1970s. And she always said, well, she intended on staying for 6 months. And, you know, more than 40 years later, she's still there. So I wouldn't go anywhere else.
Yeah, because it kind of resonates with me because my mum is English. And I was wondering about the luring back to Ireland because that's what my dad did. He was very much going, he was talking about Dublin. There's mountains, there's the sea. It's the most magical place, you know. That's how he got her back. But she did love it. She would be more now Irish than the Irish themselves years later.
Yeah, my mum would be the same, I think, as well. And I mean, she wouldn't, and even members of her family now who come over would have a huge attachment to Ireland. And she loves where she's from, but she gets a bit frustrated because I think she is now so Irish. Say things like when it came to Brexit, she was a bit, well, their problem is they don't talk about politics enough. Because you see, she's been living in a country for more than 40 years where people talk about politics all the time. And she says that she finds now that that's the biggest difference between, say, her family members in England, in Lincolnshire, and my father's family, who would, you know, talk about nothing but politics. And not even in a party political way, more in the, well, did you see your man on prime time? Oh, he's some spoofer. You know, and that they would start off a conversation like that, and that she feels is one of the big differences. Yeah.
Well, what about you as a child? Because I think for a lot of young people, if you're interested in words and writing, you kind of, the idea of writing a book can be there, but not necessarily something you act on. But journalism was something you were interested in early enough.
Yeah, I it was. And I don't know your own experience, but mine was that, while I won't say I was discouraged at school, there was a bit of scepticism. Because it was seen as A, difficult to get into unless you knew somebody, and B, just kind of a bit chancy generally. Yeah. And so there was
a bit notiony.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And I remember being told in particular that, well, you know, I can't even remember the girl's name now. Well, you know, there was so-and-so left here 2 years ago and she wanted to do that and it didn't work out for her. And she was very good at English. And
that's lovely.
There's a bit of encouragement. But I shouldn't be fair now, the career guidance teacher, who was brilliant in many ways. But If you have, I think as well, if you have one young person who keeps going to say, no, this is what I want to do, I'm determined, this is what I want to do. So it was seen as a bit notioncy. Yes, it was. It was seen as a bit, where did you get that idea from?
And where did you get that idea?
I was just always the child who read the paper, and I think, or listened to the radio. And I think it's unusual to find a journalist who wasn't that child, who didn't, you know, yeah, I just always liked reading the papers. I always liked listening to the radio. We only had the two TV channels, so there wasn't as much. But I do remember certain things, like, you know, I did watch a certain amount of news. I remember in particular Marion Finucane's programme in the 1980s when I was at school, the television programme in particular. I think it may have been on a Monday night. And I remember thinking, God, that'd be a great job, you know. So I was, then there was I ended up doing communications in DCU or NIHE Dublin as it was then, mainly because in the sort of true career guidance way of things, and to be fair to the teacher, she was probably right. She said, well, now, I'm looking at how many points you're likely to be at. You'd be wasting those doing a certificate in journalism. Because do you remember at that time, there weren't journalism
so
courses.
It was a compliment, really. She was saying, you're going to do really well. Don't waste it on some crappy old little course.
Yeah. So because at the time, there weren't any journalism courses apart from the course in Rathmines, which is a brilliant course, of course. So I ended up going to DCU and I loved it. I loved every single minute of it. Like, I had the best class. It was the best experience.
Yeah. And then you ended up with your job in RTE.
I did, after a bit of a detour. I worked in local radio for a while, which I loved, but I was very lonely for Dublin, even though I was going back home to Clare. I really missed all my friends in Dublin, who I thought were having a great time. You know, as it turned out, like, they were all on the dole and miserable. But, you know, I was convinced that, you know, it was bright lights, big city still, and that, you know, and that I was attending county council meetings in Ennis and missing all the fun. I should have stayed longer in Clare FM. I didn't. I worked briefly in PR. I was awful at it. Awful, awful, awful. Couldn't take the client seriously, just had totally the wrong attitude. As in fairness, like, I was only 22, you know, and it's very hard at that age to, I think you have a certain kind of, you know, raised eyebrow about everything. At
your
that
tolerance
age.
Is a bit
yeah,
low.
Yeah, yeah. And you sort of leave the room and go, oh, right. And so I was fortunate to get the job in RTE through, and I'll say this because people always say, who did you know? I didn't know anybody. Yeah. They advertised, and, you know, most people who certainly in news, who work in news, got a job because it was advertised.
In those days, there was a lot of just coming in from the cold, whereas it is an industry where you kind of, a lot of people do know people. I didn't know anyone either, so it's interesting when you don't come from that, you kind of are a bit more, oh God, I've really got to do this. I can't rely on anything or anybody.
Yeah, and I didn't know anybody, but I was fortunate to start work at the same time as a lot of other people. I think there were about 15 of us started within the space of a couple of months. It was a time, and this seems so different to now, it was a time when news was expanding. When, you know, the 6-1 news was a relatively new phenomenon. I mean, do you remember when there used to be any kind of 20 minutes of news that... Yeah. And there were lots of other bits and pieces that were, you know, the schedule was expanding all the time. So there actually were.
So it was a great time to be there. Yeah,
it was. Even though, you know, no, I don't think anybody leaving school in the 1980s, late 1980s, would have imagined that it was going to be a good time. But
yeah,
as it turned out, by the early 90s, things were changing a lot. Mm. And, you know, as a few of us say in the newsroom now, at least we'll always have the 90s.
Now, the other thing that's come out of RT, apart from brilliant broadcasting, is some writers like yourself. So we had Kathleen McMahon getting a big deal and Sinead Crowley, and you were sort of beavering away quietly when these successes were happening. What is it in the water, first of all, but also did you kind of see them as inspiring?
Yes, I did, certainly. With Kathleen, and I was writing at that time, I still didn't say anything, even to her, because I just wasn't confident enough about it. As I don't think anybody is when they're writing a first novel or when they just start writing short stories or something. So, but yes, it is. I think that's one of the things about writing, unlike, say, lots of other jobs, is just because one person gets a book deal, it doesn't stop you from getting it. And, you know, Claudia Carroll has this great line about it, who obviously is also an actress. And she says, you know, if there is a part in something, there is only one part, only one actress can play that part, but more than one author can write a book. And so, yes, actually, there is a certain extent to which if you see somebody doing well. And I think in particular, it works in Ireland, maybe not so much in the sort of books I write in recent years. But have you noticed the way recently there's so many women crime writers in Ireland? And I do think that maybe a couple being really successful, because you have, you know, Liz Nugent and Patricia Gibney and Joe Spain and several more.
The list is 20, very long. But Tana French and
And I think certainly that goes to illustrate, you know, for people who are interested in writing and maybe get a bit disheartened when they see other people getting a deal or whatever, that actually that's not a bad thing. It is good news, and that it does make it perhaps slightly more likely that there would be interest in your story, because if you have writers like the four we've just mentioned, and there's another probably 10 we could mention at the moment on top of that, that it does make it slightly more likely that there would be interest in what you're writing.
You were very disciplined in that you kept it very quiet, because some people can't, you know, stop themselves from talking about these things. But you did keep it quiet, and then you sent it away and you got interest in it and it all kind of happened. Were you surprised?
Yeah, I was very surprised. I was, yeah, I really was. And it did mean sort of lead to a situation where I did have to, you know, bring my colleagues together and say, now, I swear I'm not making this up. But thing is, I wrote this book and I was going to tell you about it, and then I put it off and I put it off and I put it off. But anyway, there'll be a thing in the paper tomorrow about it. And so... Yeah, and like obviously I got all the Dark Horse stuff after that, and you know, is there anything else you've not been telling us about? But I was very apprehensive about that first book, and I know people say it never gets easier, but perhaps it gets ever so slightly easier as you go along, that you have slightly more confidence in something and feel less of a need to sort of shy away at the very mention of it.
And the paper bracelet is your how many books later?
Fifth
book. It's amazing.
I never imagined that there would be five. And, you know, touch wood,
there will be six. Like, I have started the sixth one, but only in a very, you know, a very kind of sloppy, rudimentary sort of way. But I have started it, yeah.
And listen, tell us about you outside of writing and outside of RTE. What are you into? What do you do? What do you do for fun, Rachel English?
What do I do for fun? I do like sport. And I was never very good at it. You know, I played camogie very badly when I was at school. And, you know, like an awful lot of girls gave up at 14, which is a really, really stupid thing to do. And I think that is probably less likely to happen now because girls are encouraged more to keep on playing now. But I have always liked sport. With the way things have been over the past 2 or 3 months between the book and work, I haven't got to anything. But I do like, I do find something very relaxing about going to, in particular, hurling or Gaelic football. My husband's father was from Tyrone, so he supported the Tyrone footballers, which in Dublin isn't always a popular thing to do. I'm always the lone voice saying, but I quite like Tyrone. But and I in hurling, I support obviously my own county, Clare, so who are doing okay at the moment, actually, in the league. But yeah, I find something very relaxing about that, and I like the crowds at matches. I like the banter. And the other thing, I think for people who don't go to GAA matches, and the one thing I always say to people is, there are so many more women than you would expect. Certainly, I went to a soccer international not that long ago, and I was stunned how male it was. Whereas in the GAA, and it's not just like players' girlfriends and mothers and everything, there are genuinely an awful lot of young girls in particular who go to hurling and football, and obviously increasingly to women's football and to camogie as well. And it does tend to be more of a sort of a family bantery atmosphere. Not that there isn't a great atmosphere at the soccer, it's just, it's a lot more male. And I was taken aback by that. I thought it would have changed, but because it had been a while since I'd been to a soccer international, but it hasn't.
And are you a disciplined kind of writer? Because you're on your sixth one now. Do you kind of, you're able to go part-time, that's what writing has done for you. You only do how many days a week?
I only do 2 days a week.
I'm you're worried. Hardly there.
I know, well, I've done more recently, to be fair, because of the times that are in it. A lot more recently. But it, yes, but I'm disciplined because I genuinely enjoy it. And if I didn't, I wouldn't be, and I probably wouldn't do it at all. If the day ever came where I found that it was a drag or where I felt under a huge amount of pressure to write a certain amount of words a day, or that I felt it was very pressurized. Like bringing out a book is kind of pressurized, but writing it shouldn't feel like that. There should be a certain amount of joy in it. And if there wasn't, I don't think I'd do it.
And what feedback have you had so far? Because it's in the world now; it's in the shops.
Yeah, it's been very kind so far. I mean, you can't. There's you know, obviously the day is going to come where you're going to read something and go, oh, well, maybe they have a point or whatever. But so far, yeah, it's been lovely, and people have been very kind. And sure, but it is it's. Very early days. I'll see how it goes. I don't want to say anything to jinx it. So, a bit superstitious like that. I am the person who salutes the magpies and touches the wood. And I know it's stupid, but I do it.
Well, I think it's a brilliant book. It is one of those, it's a bit of a cliche, but it's a page turner. You're really dying to find out how all the threads come back together. And Katie's a great character. And as you say, because she's that bit older and she still has such a life and lots going on with her, she's a great read. So congratulations on your fifth book.
Thanks so
and
much.
And I hope you come and
really
talk
grateful.
To us again for the sixth one.
Hopefully
and for
so.
The one where you expose all the secrets of Morning Ireland.
Oh, that's the one to look forward to.
Thanks, Rachel English.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode. Thanks to my guest, Rachel English, and her book is called Paper Bracelet, and I really couldn't recommend it more. If you want to get in touch with us, do so on Instagram or Twitter at IT Women's Podcast, and you can email us on thewomenspodcast@irishtimes.com. The podcast is produced by me, Roisin Ingle, and by Suzanne Brennan with JJ Vernon on sound. That's all we have time for. Stay safe, and thank you very much for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.